When the Kiowas were routed in Palo Duro Canyon by the cavalry, they were herded to Fort Sill, and they were imprisoned in the old stone corral, which still stands. And their ponies, their horses, the Kiowas were said to own more horses than any other, per capita, than any other tribe on the Great Plains. Their horses were destroyed within their hearing. 800 ponies were killed. In The Ancient Child, which is a novel that was published in 1989, there is the story of a contemporary artist, a painter, whose name is Set, Kaplan Set, Locke Setman. And he's a painter who has achieved great success. He lives in San Francisco. He was orphaned at a very young age, raised by a professor, retired philosopher, a man of very great humanity, whose name is Bent. And Set becomes a great painter. But the more success he achieves, the more limited he becomes in the expression of his own creativity. And I want to read, first of all, a passage about Set. By the time he was 30, Locke Setman, called Set by all who knew him, had found the truest expression of his spirit in painting. At 35, he had made a considerable reputation, having received several important awards and attracted the attention of critics and collectors throughout the country. It was fashionable and expensive to own one of his paintings. At 40, he was in the first rank of American artists, and he was in danger of losing his soul. Innumerable demands were made upon him. He came to understand that success in terms of fame and fortune was costly in other terms. More and more often, he was asked to compromise his art or himself in one way or another. And more often than not, he did so, for he was inclined to be passive and naive. It was difficult for him to say no. Those who exhibited his work, who praised and purchased it, and who demanded its proliferation began to determine it. Set went along. He enjoyed celebrity. It was wonderful to be recognized, to be sought after, to be admired and envied and imitated. Men of means invited him to their clubs, prevailed upon him to speak at their luncheons, gave parties in his honor. Women took notice of him, approached him, laid claim to him, and he went along. There were times when the disillusionment was so great that he wept. It was such a fine thing to paint, to see something, a human face or an orchard or a moon rolling, and to render it, to make a picture of it according to his vision, which was unique. To see and to paint with excitement, with a child's excitement, that is what brought him to life. The child says, "Here, see, this bird I have painted. It is what I have seen in my soul. Is it not a wonderful thing? Is this not a good way of seeing?" Set strove to see and to image what he saw as truly as he could, so that others could see as he did, so that they could see in a way they had not seen before. But it seemed no one cared about that. No one among his associates, his public. He wanted a child. He wanted a child to come to his studio to look at the splatter of paint on the walls, the floor, his easel, to see the drawings on the walls, to touch his or her hands to the thickly painted linen planes, to say to the child, just look at this yellow, how it vibrates. Look at the blues, how they make a mystery. Could you have imagined a blue like this? And for a moment the child's eyes would have been wide with wonder. But the dealers and critics were narrow-eyed and glib, and there were calculations in all their faces. Notwithstanding, there was conviction in him and a commitment to be his own man. And therefore he struggled. Now at 44, he found himself in a difficult position. He had compromised more than he knew. He had squandered much of his time and talent. He had become sick and tired. He remembered a time in which he had painted for the sake of painting, out of some wild exuberance in his spirit. He had been full of excitement. The excitement of learning, of experimenting, of feeling his ability and his accomplishment come close together. But he had committed his time and his work, virtually all of it, to his public. At every breath, it seemed, another painting or promise came due. Moreover, he had ceased to grow in his work. He wanted to paint a tree, but he was obliged to paint a house. He wanted to paint small, but he was obliged to paint large. He wanted to do something he had never done, but he was obliged to do the same thing again and again without end. Yes. He had become sick and tired, and he did the only thing he could think to do under the circumstances. He withdrew. Not completely, not all at once, but deliberately. He would fulfill his obligations, to be sure. Indeed, he would give the best that was in him. But he would first and last be true to himself. He would endeavor to save his soul. About the same time, he painted a self-portrait, a full-length study in acrylic on paper. It was a good likeness, though Set was not a portraitist, and the likeness, though close, was stylized, essentially abstract. Blues and greens and an ivory predominate upon a background of brown and black. The figure faces us in a relaxed attitude, standing with feet well apart, the hands on the hips. Work clothes, splotched with paint, hang as on a mannequin. The body appears to be that of a tall man. The torso is long, though the shoulders and thighs are well rounded like the shoulders and thighs of a swimmer. The hands and feet are slim, the arms and neck disproportionately long, but somehow in keeping with the general character of the portrait. The head is inclined slightly to one side. The hair is blue and gray and unkempt, of a length that nearly covers the ears. The face is strong, with a high, broad forehead, a straight nose, a sturdy jaw, and a chin cleanly set. The expression is inscrutable, but we take it to be benign. The mouth, which is full, might describe the faintest of smiles. The eyes are slightly narrow, as if the subject is looking into the sun. The gaze is level, and penetrating. The portrait is that of a thoughtful and well-meaning man, a man of intelligence and some experience, a man of sorrow, a man of deep feelings. Set imagined it was to please, but it was to astonish God that he painted. His presumption and arrogance were pronounced and dangerous, for they would certainly lead to the sin of despair, thence to death and nothingness. Bent said so, half in jest, only half. Rather, as Set himself said on occasion, he painted in vain in order to relieve the terrible boredom of God. He expounded, God's boredom is infinite. Surely we humans, even with our etiquette and our institutions and our mothers-in-law, ceased to amuse him many ages ago. What sustains him is the satisfaction, far deeper than we can know, of having created a few incomparables. Landscapes, waters, birds and beasts. He takes particular pride in the stars, and it pleases him to breathe havoc upon the oceans. He sighs to the music of the desert at dawn. The eagle and the whale give him still to ponder and admire. And so must he grieve for the mastodon and the archaeopteryx, the bear. Ah! He used both hands when he made the bear. Imagine a bear proceeding from the hands of God. The girl Gray in the novel is half Navajo, half Kiowa. She is a medicine woman. Set's destiny is to run to the edge of the world and beyond. He is the boy bear. He is the reincarnation of the boy who turned into a bear. There's a legend about this in Kiowa storytelling. So he has this bear power in him, and he has to discover it in the course of the novel. He has to deal with it, and at the end, he must come to a confrontation with the bear. Gray, the girl, assists him. She is a medicine woman, a 19-year-old medicine woman, which is fairly rare. They're generally older than that. But she's very beautiful. She's very learned, and she assists him, and she falls in love with him, and she finally becomes pregnant by him. She doesn't give birth by the time the novel is finished, but she's, you know, there is this in the offing. And Set comes to the confrontation. Well, Gray is a creature of great imaginative powers. And she fantasizes about Billy the Kid. She knows more than other people do about Billy the Kid, and she writes, in the course of this novel, she writes a kind of paean to Billy, a piece of 21 parts, 21 poems and short prose pieces, one for each year of Billy the Kid's life. She imagines that she assists him in his most trying moments when he escapes, for example, from the Lincoln County Courthouse. She imagines that it is she who goes to the courthouse and passes him the note on a thin strip of cigarette paper as she shakes his hand. She passes the note which reads latrine. And Billy the Kid knows at that point that a gun is secreted in the latrine. And so he goes down with Bell, one of his guards, and there in a folded-up copy of the New Mexican, which I think is entirely appropriate, is the pistol, the gun, which he then places in his belt, and he's shackled hand and foot, like Setanya, and he leads Bell up the steps, Bell, you know, his guard, and at a certain moment he turns, having taken the gun from his belt, and he turns, and the gun is in Bell's face. And that is this is the greatest escape story, I think, in American literature, and it's true. You know, that's what makes it wonderful. He says to Bell, "I don't want to hurt you. You have been good to me." Unlike Ollinger, the other guard, who has taunted Billy and made his life miserable, Billy says to Bell, "I don't want to hurt you. For God's sake, don't do anything foolish, because I'll kill you if I have to." And Bell is, of course, humiliated and overcome by having the tables turned on him. And so he tries to escape. They're on the stairs, and the first stairway goes down to a landing, and then there's a right angle, and there's another stairway down to the street. And Bell, you know, foolishly decides that he can make a break for it, and if he turns that blind corner, he's safe. But what he doesn't take into account, of course, is that there is behind him the greatest coordination of mind and muscle in the Southwest. So he makes a break for it, and Billy is very sad to see him do that. And there are these two shots. One strikes Bell in the back and spins him around the corner, and he's dead. Falls into the street. Ollinger, who is in the Wortley Hotel across the street in Lincoln, hears a shot. He thinks. He's suddenly very alert, drinking his lunch. And he said, did I hear a shot? What's going on? So he ventures out into the street, crosses the street, and as he's under the window, he hears Billy's familiar voice. "Hello, Bob." And he looks up into the twin barrels of his own shotgun. His signature was a double-barrel shotgun. He left it in the courthouse when he went to lunch, and Billy got hold of it. And so Billy shoots him. I could go into the gory details of that, but I think I won't. He makes his escape, and Gray, you know, fantasizes about him in this way. She assists him in that great moment in his life. She's with him at other moments in his life. She tells him about Setanya, chief of the Kaitsenko Society, the Kiowa chief of the Crazy Dog Society, who is the model of bravery and courage to her. And she says, "Billy, oh, I want to tell you about this old man. He was a wonderful man. He was the leader of the Kaitsenko Society. He went and gathered up the bones of his son. He orchestrated his own death, you know, laughing, singing. At the time, what a wonderfully courageous and brave man. Billy, if you had been there in that time and place, you would have been a member of the Kaitsenko Society." Billy says, "Me? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The man you're talking about was truly brave. He did great things, you know, to go and gather up the bones of his son in that way and to carry them around. And then to die in the way he did, that was brave. But I am not brave. And she's a little put off by his protestations, you know, and she said, "Now wait a minute, Billy, you remember the time in Lincoln when you killed Sheriff Brady? Remember that? Brady had confiscated that rifle from you in February, and then, you know, 3 months later you shot him dead in the street. And there were, you know, he had lots of men with him, you had lots of men with you. There was this kind of general warfare in the street of Lincoln. Bullets were flying back and forth. You went out to gather up, to fetch your gun, and you were wounded in the leg. You were hit in the thigh. You remember that? You were crippled. You couldn't ride for days after that. That was brave. It was a brave thing to do." And Billy says, "No. That wasn't brave. That was stupid." And so they go on like this for a time, and he says, "Besides, there's one other reason. There's another reason I could not belong to the Kartsenko Society. I can't sing." So she imagines a meeting between Billy the Kid and Setanka. The old man sat on the ground, his head bent, his legs crossed. Within his reach was the bundle of bones, the bones of his son. There was a sound, and he brought his head up sharply, glaring. The young man was standing a few feet away beside a pomme blanche, waiting respectfully for the old man to acknowledge him. Respectfully, too, he was looking not directly at the old man nor at the bones of his son, but to one side where there was a small stand of willows.
"Paul! How long have you been standing there?"
he said. Clearly the old man was unsettled, perhaps ashamed of being taken by surprise. "Not long," Billy said.
Well, what do you want?"
"I come to pay my respects. I come to visit you and your son. Here's tobacco."
"Oh, you know my son?"
"In a way."
"In a way."
There was a pause in which the old man seemed to ponder this "in a way." He looked down at the bundle of bones, crushing a pinch of the tobacco in his fingers, then up again.
You are about the same age, I think."
"Yes."
"And do you know me too? In a way."
You are Setanya, Sitting Bear, a warrior and chief as great as his name. Over all the prairies, you are famous for your bravery and your deeds. Your mind is true, your words are true, and your heart is true. The eagle knows your name. The buffalo knows your name. The bear knows your name. The white man knows your name. You are Setanya, chief of the Kartsenko Society, chief of the crazy dogs, chief of the dog soldiers. Yours are the best of warriors. Yours are the best of battles. Yours are the best of enemies. You are Setanta, who does not surrender his son to death, who dares to withhold victory from even the greatest of all enemies. Hear me, old man brave to madness. Oh, my warrior! You and your son, great chief, you are worthy of each other in your courage and loyalty and love and bigness of spirit. Your son in his bones and you in your flesh and blood are of the same sacred mystery, the same medicine, most powerful. Hear me. I am honored to make you this speech, to make you this respectful visit, to stand here in your company, O Sitting Bear, yours and your son. I have spoken. Oh, you have spoken well, said the old man, gravely, after the appropriate silence. Now I know you. I know you way. You are surely a famous orator among your people. Well, no, sir. My son, I do not admire modesty. I like boasting. I love to boast. And I love others to boast if they have something to boast about. You have very pretty words about you. Why don't you boast of them?
Well, I'm right proud you like my speech, sir. But to tell you the truth, it ain't mine. You see, my girlfriend wrote it up, and I learnt it.
I cannot read. I cannot read myself.
I memorized it, and then I declaimed it.
Why?
I wanted you to like me.
Yes.
I wanted to talk to you about death, but I'm a man of few words.
Yes. There is something about you. There is a sign, a mark upon you. And there was a mark upon my son, and there is a mark upon me. But I am an old man, and so for me it matters very little. But my son, you are young men, and you are marked men. It is a thing heavy on my heart.
I have so few words, and I wanted you to like me.
I know you, in a way.
I'm a dead man.
Yes. Tell me, did you achieve your death in the proper way?
I guess so. It happened so fast, and I wasn't expecting it, not at that moment. Though I had been looking into the shadows for a long time.
My son died in the proper way.
So did you.
Ah, you've heard about that. Yes, so they say. You know, there was not a whimper, no pleading, no shame.
I had no time for any of that.
Yeah, yes, yeah. I think neither did my son. But I had time. And I neither whimpered nor pled. Rather, I sang.
I can't sing. Well, that's enough.